This is Dr. What, Dr. Where, Stories of Rural Medicine. It's the podcast exploring what it's like to live, work, and train in rural medicine across regional Victoria. I'd like to begin this episode by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land we live and work on, and recognise their continuing connection to the land and waterways. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and extend this to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening to this podcast. We're publishing this episode on International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, exploring cultural safety in Indigenous medicine, as well as growing the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander medical workforce. But if you don't identify as Indigenous or don't specifically work in Indigenous health, learning about cultural safety is the best way to help address the poorer health outcomes that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people face. Not only that, it can develop a better understanding and awareness of patient needs no matter where you're practicing. We spoke to Māori man Abe Ropatini, the Executive Director of Population Health at the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, to learn more about how these factors can have a positive influence on Indigenous health outcomes.
Yeah, Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisations have existed for just over 50 years now. The very first one in Australia was established in Redfern in New South Wales. And then the second one in the country was the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service, or VARS, which was established here in Melbourne in Fitzroy. And that was exactly 50 years ago. So VARS is celebrating their jubilee this year. That service was established by a group of Aboriginal community elders who at the time partnered up with a group of really progressive, really radical doctors to create an alternative health system for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, because there was a recognition that the outcomes that we were seeing with relying on the mainstream health service system were really poor, really inequitable. There's an enormous amount of exposure to racism for mob that were getting access to services through the mainstream care system. And so Aboriginal people across the whole country have, as a result of that, had to establish their own health services. So the community controlled sector now has grown since that time to be composed of 33 Aboriginal community controlled health organizations in Victoria and over 150 nationally. So in the state of Victoria, those 33 organizations are members of VATRO. 26 years ago, those organizations came together and determined that they needed to establish a peak body, which could be a voice for Aboriginal health and wellbeing outcomes in this state. And that was agreed. And then a peak was established. And that is the organization that I now work for, VATRO, which is the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organization. We also have a national peak body as well, which is NACHO. And so they advocate for us at a national level.
You have this Victorian Aboriginal Health and Wellbeing Workforce Strategy, which covers a whole range of priorities that really need to be tackled within Indigenous health. And the first priority is specifically around growing our own, so increasing the number and proportion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people employed in the sector. How does that really help with the work you're doing in Indigenous health?
I think it comes down to trust. I think it comes down to having a really high trust environment within the setting of care that you're receiving health services, and a really high trust dynamic in the relationship that you have with the person that you're relying on to guide your health and wellbeing decisions. So for most people, it's kind of taken for granted that the doctor that you're working with will be able to undertake an assessment and will generally be able to understand, what's going on in your life. For Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, they have really good reasons not to place trust in mainstream health services, and not necessarily to place trust in non-Aboriginal health professionals, because throughout history, what we've seen is that unconscious bias and sometimes, structural racism, when Aboriginal people have been asked to place trust in health services and in health professionals, the result has been adverse outcomes. And so we feel that we need to grow the number of Aboriginal identified people who work in health, and we really want to make the pathways into careers in health more culturally safe for people. Our strategy that you mentioned is all around how we can attract more mob into working in health, how we can recruit more people and then retain them, and then foster their ongoing development so that they can go into leading roles to be able to affect some of the change that we need to see at a structural level. So it's a long-term strategy, but it starts with looking at how we train health professionals and actually getting into the curriculum within universities and being able to say that there needs to be a lot more of an equity focus. We need to stop separating health from the social determinants of health. We need also to look at some really fundamental important things for achieving outcomes in what is a colonized country here, which is the cultural determinants of health, and recognition of the fact that most people rely on several generations of accumulated knowledge and wisdom, which is passed on from your elders onto young ones that are born and grow up really strong in culture. And that's the thing that was stolen from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So a restoration of that is really strongly needed. And we need health professionals working today who understand that and can work in models of care that are designed to produce those outcomes. And they really only exist within the Aboriginal community controlled sector. Our strategy is also around strengthening that sector so that those models of care can really be backed in by investment from government under, labels like closing the gap, but actually also just, to empower local communities and across Victoria to be able to determine for themselves what an appropriate model of care looks like to be able to address both health outcomes and then also the social determinants of health as well.
Alongside that, for non-Indigenous healthcare workers, a big aspect of supporting this is cultural safety. Can you provide a bit of an overview of how that works from the clinician perspective?
Cultural safety is the patient's experience. It can only really be determined by what a patient is experiencing, whether they feel safe to place trust in the person that they are talking to in a clinical environment, and that they can feel that they can be totally honest and upfront about what's going on in their lives. You can only really have that level of trust and honesty if you feel culturally safe. And so for clinicians, the responsibility is to practice in such a way as to create that environment and that atmosphere of trust. For health professionals, the first thing to really understand in respect of cultural safety is that your practice needs to be grounded in a strong understanding of who you are. And by that, I don't necessarily mean who you are as a professional and that, you have legitimacy as a professional because you've gone to medical school and because you have, you're a fellow of a college and you've got however many years of experience, doing your residency and going on and, becoming a specialist, either as a GP or as a non-GP specialist, but actually, that you know who you are as a person and as somebody who has grown up in a culture and as somebody who, has a family and is part of a community and who experiences health and well-being through the friendships that you have, through the family that you have, through, who you choose to spend time with, the food that you eat, the music that you listen to. All of that is fundamental to everybody's health and well-being. And when you're really strongly grounded in an understanding of who you are in that context, it makes it more possible for you to see what's going on in the lives of other people. And so cultural safety at a fundamental level, that's a simple way of describing it. But the challenge that we have in actually having medical professionals adopt culturally safe practice is that we actually train medical professionals not to identify in quite that way when you're delivering health services. We actually put you through a process of being educated out of, bringing yourself and your personal lens and your own life experiences and your own culture into the consulting room with you. So, throughout the training pathway, we actually try to alienate you from it. And we imprint upon you a new identity of, a doctor or a nurse. And we try to really sort of introduce you to a new culture and a new identity as a medical professional, which is defined in terms of how you look at a patient, how you assess, you know, what a patient is there for, and to really medicalize your view of what those people are coming to seek help for. Then we ask you to come and see us to do your cultural safety training. And the first thing we say is it's time to unlearn all of that and go back to basics about who you are, where you're from, so that you can understand more about who your patients are, where your patients are from, and all of the things that are going on in their life, which may be, you know, leading them to experience a greater degree of stress, maybe potentially leading them to experience a greater degree of loneliness or isolation or, you know, struggle in life. So from that perspective, you know, cultural safety is around unlearning a lot of the things that we imprint upon you throughout the training that we put you through to become a health professional. And that makes it really challenging. But at a really fundamental level, it's about going back to having a high trust, honest relationship between two individuals that isn't defined by dynamics of power in the way that it often is when you've got doctor and patient having a dialogue together, but actually that is defined by a dialogue of discussing how you as a health professional can best support the patients that you work with to be able to exercise self-determination in the decisions that they are making in respect of their health. In order to do that, you need to create an atmosphere and an environment within your consulting room where they can be totally honest, upfront with you about everything that's going on in their life, and they know that you will be respectful of the trust that they place in you. That's what it is, you know, within 5 minutes. We could talk all day about it, but at a summary level, that's a reasonable description of what we want patients to experience when they're coming in to see the doctor.
And it sounds like cultural safety more broadly is a useful skill to have no matter what culture, what race the patient's from. There's obviously a lot of differences in Indigenous health to do with the massive weight of history that sort of has held this sector back for decades, centuries really. But also, Indigenous people have different health outcomes, different needs. Often their health outcomes are significantly worse. So how does cultural safety work to combat these factors?
I think that's right. I think that anybody can feel culturally unsafe. I think that there are ways in which anyone can feel like they can't trust the doctor that they're speaking to or the nurse that they're speaking to. It's the role of people within the health system to look at those dynamics of trust and to design settings of care that build trust and that build, you know, a really strong atmosphere and feeling of safety before you've even seen the doctor that you're there to see. There's a reason why we have hospitals for women. There's a reason why we have hospitals for children. And it's because they experience really unique things that health professionals have to be specifically trained to be responsive to. And in particular, in the way that we communicate and the way that we, you know, support them to be able to exercise their self-determination to guide their own health journey. We train health professionals to be able to do that specifically for, you know, women who might be at the Jane Kerner Hospital or at the Royal Women's Hospital or for kids that might be in the Royal Children's Hospital. You know, we train people to be able to communicate appropriately and to be able to create that atmosphere and that environment of safety and trust, right? When we talk about cultural safety, it's not too dissimilar to that. Cultural safety is important for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in particular because of that historical legacy of harm that has been inflicted by, you know, processes of colonization that have removed people from their traditional lands and that have basically, or almost, and I'm speaking from, I'm in southeastern Australia here in Victoria, where colonization was very brutal and was very quick and was very effective at actually removing people's connection to culture and to kinship and to community. And that was done in large part by people who thought that they were acting benevolently as health professionals and as public health people. A lot of harm was inflicted upon Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here. And so, you know, in recognition of that history, cultural safety is about, you know, saying that Aboriginal people walking into a hospital may come in with a deficit in trust and good reasons not to trust, because the experience that their parent may have had, or that their nan may have had, or that their, you know, brother or sister may have had in that hospital, maybe one which is, you know, associated with a fair amount of trauma. And so the need for us to adopt culturally safe practice, the need for us to create atmospheres and environments and settings of care that help to facilitate trust in relationships with health professionals, and trust in relationships with health institutions, has never been more acute, because we're seeing that in the year 2023, still a fair amount of harm that is being inflicted by people who are, you know, only doing what they were trained to do as health professionals, but are inadvertently producing outcomes that are inequitable. So everybody needs to have an ongoing, proactive, conscious commitment to embedding cultural safety into their practice. And there are a range of ways in which health professionals can do that. It starts with really engaging with cultural safety training, and it starts with seeking out opportunities to build relationships with Aboriginal community-controlled organizations, with your Aboriginal health units within hospitals, if you work in a hospital setting, and having a dialogue about how your practice can be adapted or can change in order to better facilitate honesty and trust in the dialogue that you're having with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients and their families.
As Abe said, cultural safety is important for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but also helps take your medical skills to the next level. Dr. Daniel Kinsella is a GP currently working at the Bendigo and District Aboriginal Cooperative. He says training and practicing in Indigenous health has helped him develop skills he uses across all aspects of general practice.
So cultural safety is so important because, you know, it's the history of this country, and what's happened here, you know, with European colonisation and forced removal of Aboriginal people from their homes, their families. In Aboriginal health today, there is a lot of challenges. There is mistrust in the system. And so, you know, we need to work with a culturally appropriate or a culturally safe framework in order to, you know, improve healthcare outcomes for Aboriginal people. Not only that, the Aboriginal framework or the Aboriginal lens for health and well-being does differ from the traditional, you know, Western medical approach to healthcare. And, you know, that can be something that's difficult to navigate as doctors and healthcare workers coming from the Western approach. So I think there's a lot we can learn from both systems, and when the two can mesh together in that, that's that sweet spot where you've got cultural safety, you've got cultural awareness, and you're working together to improve outcomes.
And those differences, practicing culturally safe with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, what are some of those differences you've experienced that perhaps other doctors should be aware of?
I guess working in an ARCHO, an Aboriginal medical service, it fosters cultural awareness in yourself. So, you know, it asks you to, you know, question some of your beliefs, some of your biases, some of your subconscious biases, and reflect. So that's one of the things I really like about it. To give an example, you know, there's culturally based beliefs about health that happen all the time, day to day on the job. And as a doctor, you need to navigate this during the diagnostic process. For me, that makes the job more stimulating, more challenging. And I really like that, but it can be difficult. For example, just last week, there's an elder that I'm seeing, and we're in the process of diagnosing dementia. One of the cultural beliefs that this person has is that the changes that are happening to them might be payback for a previous wrongdoing. You know, that's really interesting, and that's really challenging to navigate that. And to me, you know, that's the art of medicine, and particularly in Aboriginal health. And the way to do that, I think, is by involving the team. You know, the Aboriginal health workers are worth their weight in gold, the nurses, the whole team, to help communicate a diagnosis, to help communicate a healthcare issue to someone when they're coming from, you know, a different lens, a different walk of life. So Yeah, that's where I think cultural safety is, at the coalface.
Has developing that awareness of cultural safety had a flow-on effect to treating non-Indigenous people when you're practicing?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think working in an Aboriginal health service, it fosters cultural awareness like no other place. And like I touched on earlier, it makes you reflect on your own point of view, your own values, and that does have, knock-on effects to work with anyone. At a baseline, it's just about respect for people from different walks of life that are different to yours. And I absolutely notice that in my own practice, in my mainstream clinic that I do half my week also. So yeah, it's another added benefit. It's a wonderful thing.
When you were training to become a doctor, did Indigenous health stand out to you as something that you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, it did. I mean, where I grew up in Lake Tyers, East Gippsland, and there's an Aboriginal mission and Aboriginal trust there. So, I grew up with, a lot of community down that way, Gunai-Kurnai country. When I was a junior doctor, I did 6 months up in Alice Springs, and that really got me excited or got me involved in working in an ARCHO. I just saw the ways that they made these really creative and innovative ways to tackle the barriers that face people in Central Australia, geographically, racially. So I thought that was just, amazing. And that was something I wanted to be a part of. So then when I was a GP registrar, I worked at VARS, the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service in Melbourne. And that was, that was a fantastic experience. That's a really wonderful and well-oiled ARCHO. And yeah, it's more than that. It's a political organisation as well. It advocates for closing the gap on Aboriginal health disadvantage, and it's got a really powerful and profound history in Melbourne. So, as a trainee, that's something that's really special to be a part of. And again, now where I work in Bendigo at Bedak, it's also a really powerful organisation and political organisation in the area, and it's growing. So it's not only that, but it's also a great community and a great family. There's not just the cultural aspects to working in an ARCHO, but there's the social as well. It's a really social environment, and it's akin to more to working in a hospital, I would say. In mainstream general practice, you can be siloed sometimes, working on your own, whereas in an ARCHO, you're always in a team. You're always working with an Aboriginal health worker, a nurse, specialists. So that team-based approach to things is really great.
How did those experiences shape your overall training that you did working towards becoming a doctor?
Yeah, I think it really shaped me. I guess in several different ways. Firstly, from that cultural lens, which we've already spoken about in terms of fostering cultural awareness, cultural safety. And certainly from a medical point of view as well, if you work in an ARCHO, you're going to see excellent medicine. You're going to see things that you just don't see in mainstream services. For example, me this year, I've seen multiple chronic suppurative otitis medias. I've seen post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. I treat Hep B, Hep C regularly, prescribe HIV medications. You see complex diabetes, complex COPD, and you have to be there and you have to treat it. Not only that, you see true emergencies as well. As mob often prefer to present to a trusted place like an ARCHO rather than the emergency department. So you manage AMIs, you manage respiratory failure with COPD exacerbations, you manage acute APO. So you get that real breadth of clinical and medical experience that just sets you up to be a really solid and a really good doctor, no matter what setting you're going to work in the future.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about the study and training opportunities across regional Victoria by heading to monash.edu/medicine/rural-health. This episode was part of a series of conversations with doctors in regional Victoria. There's more episodes available which focus on a wide range of medical specialties. We're available anywhere you can find good podcasts. The Northwest Victoria and Gippsland Regional Training Hubs have commissioned this podcast to help medical students and junior doctors learn more about training and practicing medicine in regional Australia. There are hubs all across the country, and to find out where your nearest regional training hub is, visit the link in the episode show notes or just search regional training hubs. And finally, this podcast was brought to you by Monash Rural Health, presented by Patrick Laverick, that's me, and it was made possible by funding from the Rural Health Multidisciplinary Training Program at the Commonwealth Department of Health.